I remember the first time my parents entrusted me with the what I thought at the time was a great privilege, although later I became very tired of it. The great honor of being able to walk home for the first time. I don't know if you can remember that, when you first walked home by yourself. It was a momentous occasion. And I was playing at my friend's house. Christopher was his name. And he lived a mere 10-minute walk from my house. So it wasn't a massive distance that I had to cover. But nevertheless, it was a momentous occasion for me. And I remember after having spent the morning and the early afternoon with my friend at his house, gathering up all my things into my bag and setting off home. And I set out and I knew the direction to go. My parents had explained it to me. They had shown it to me. Christopher's parents had cleared it with me before I left. And so I set out, bags packed, on my way. And I walked and I got to the end of the road and I thought, no, this doesn't look as familiar as I remember. So I thought, but I'm pretty sure it's right. So I went right and followed and went to another road. And I thought, you know, this doesn't look very familiar either. So I thought, okay, I'll just go left. So I went left and anyway, did this for what felt like hours. Walking around and walking around and just couldn't recognize any of the streets. They all looked the same. And this is when my family first began to realize that I have absolutely no sense of direction whatsoever. I'm a bit like a bat without sonar. But walking and walking and walking for what felt like hours. And eventually, I give up. Take my bag off, plonk it down on the pavement next to the road, sit down, head in my face in my hands, and just feeling very downcast. Wasn't quite weeping, of course, no, still keeping composure, but really didn't know what I was going to do from here. And then suddenly I heard a voice, Andre. And I looked up, and there was my dad in his car, window down, saying, Andre, what are you doing? So I said, well, I'm lost, Dad. I'm lost. He said, well, don't you know where you are? So I said, I have no idea where I am. If I knew where I was, I wouldn't be in this position. He said, well, don't you recognize that house over there? And I looked to the house and I realized, hang on, I do recognize that house. It wasn't my house. It was my friend Christopher's house. And I had walked and walked and walked and walked in complete circles and had ended up across the road opposite his house. And so my parents drove me home. That was my first ever experience. But sometimes heading out on a journey by ourselves can be something that is difficult. And in some sense, this is a parallel to the Christian life. We are on a journey. We're heading for home. But nobody ever said it was going to be easy. Nobody ever said it was going to be without complications. Nobody ever said that there would not be obstacles or hurdles along the way. Nobody ever said that as we set out for home, we would not be confused, that we'd not feel lost. Our story is a story about a man heading for home. Right at the beginning of chapter 31, Jacob heard Laban's sons were saying, Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all his wealth from what belonged to our father. And Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude towards him was not what it had been. And this is the divine initiative that begins the story of this chapter, that begins Jacob's journey home. In verse 3, the Lord said to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. And what I think reading through this passage is that it will help us with three encouragements for us as we journey on our way back home. But I'll explain that in a little bit. First of all, just to headline the story. So things begin to change. There's a gathering storm at the beginning of this chapter. Jacob is not quite as welcome as he has been. He's always been highly favored in the household. Doesn't mean he's always been treated well. But he has gotten himself into a situation where he has bargained 14 years of his life away for the two women that he married. The first he was conned into marrying, and so had to contract himself for another 7 years to marry the woman he really loved. We've seen that that doesn't go well, as you could expect. Being married to two women is never a good idea, especially if you really don't love one of them and only love the other. And we saw the tension and how God intervened into that and showed mercy to both of those sisters. Then we saw how Jacob decided that he would need to provide for his own family. He needed not only to look after someone else's property and their crops and their sheep, but also he needs to start accumulating something of his own. So he strikes up another deal, another 6-year contract with Laban, where he works under against the odds to say, "Can I have a small percentage of all the profits that I make for you?" And he does that. But he is so prosperous against the odds, saying, "Look, if there's a streaked or spotted lamb," and this keeps changing, and God keeps on providing for him, and he's so prosperous that now things are starting to turn. Whereas before, Laban always valued how good a servant Jacob was, how his prosperity had always benefited Laban well. Now there's a little bit of jealousy creeping in. He is so prosperous that the sons begin to say, "Everything our father owned, Jacob has taken and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father." In other words, Jacob is conning us. Jacob is robbing us in broad daylight. And that the attitude begins to turn from their sons. But not only the sons in verse 2, Laban's attitude changes as well. And it's in this context of a gathering storm, of real strife, that God appears to Jacob and speaks to him and gives him his word, which is to go back to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I will be with you. And so this sends Jacob to talk to his wives, Rachel and Leah, and explains all that's happened to him. "Look, things are not the same as they've always been. Your father is turning his attitude towards me, is souring. It's becoming worse and worse. So are your brothers. They're turning against me too. We can't stay here. And more than that, God himself has spoken to me and said, go back to the land of your fathers." And rather surprisingly, Rachel and Leah are very keen for this. They agree. They say, "Look, it's not only you that our father has despised, it's us as well. We're part of your household now. We're not valuing him or his gods or his household. We're with you, and we're with your God. So do what he says." And they both affirm in a very positive way in verse 16, "So do whatever God has told you. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God told you to." And so Jacob sends them away. He gets ready, he packs up, and he flees immediately without question. Sends them on their way back to his own home country. But Laban, obviously, when he figures out what's going on, and also when he figures out that something else has happened. So in verse 19, they didn't just leave as they should have done, but perhaps a little bit prematurely. So Jacob deceives Laban, it says in verse 20, by not telling him that he was running away. Now that's a little bit more complicated. So it wasn't really wrong for Jacob not to tell Laban that he was leaving. Jacob was scared for his life. Who says that Laban would have given him a friendly goodbye, would have sent him on his way with tambourines and dancing, as he will later go on to say to Jacob? Who says that that would have been true? And so it's not exactly clear as to whether or not that was such a terrible thing, but the way that it's phrased in verse 20 seems to make it clear that Jacob was acting somewhat according to his usual tricks. We know that Jacob literally means to grab by the heel, and it's a kind of idiom in Hebrew for being one who deceives, one who tricks, and that word is used in verse 20. Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him he was running away. So he fled with all he had, crossing the river. But more than that, in verse 19, Rachel does something a little bit below board as well. She stole her father's household gods. She stole her father's household gods. Now, why would you do that? For what possible reason? And at first, you might be thinking that, well, this is Rachel going back to her old ways, turning back to the idols. This is something that we've seen God's people do. This is something that we've seen Rachel do. Just two chapters ago, she turns to mandrakes, which were kind of a magical recipe for, or ingredient in recipes for fertility. And she turns and puts her faith in mandrakes when she should have put her trust in God. So maybe this is Rachel turning back to the gods of old. But it seems strange if that is the case, because just earlier on we've noticed that really positive comment that both Rachel and Leah make. Whatever God has told you, that is what you should do. Do what God, Yahweh, your God, has told you to do. So I don't think the reason Rachel stole the gods was because she wanted to worship them. Later on she'll stuff them in a camel's, a saddlebag, and sits on the saddlebag with the gods tucked away underneath to protect herself. And that's not necessarily a sign of respect to her gods. If she really valued them and thought they were gods, that's not something that you would do, particularly not in ancient Near Eastern culture. Now, I think what Rachel was doing here was simply getting back at her father. You've been robbing us. You've been robbing us for years. By robbing my husband, you've been robbing your daughters. The irony is that Laban would then go on later to accuse Jacob of mistreating his daughters and will make him swear by God that he won't mistreat his daughters. But the irony is Laban is the one who's been robbing his own daughters all along. And I think Rachel is angry and she hits back and she takes what is most valuable, what is most precious. She hits where it hurts, in other words. And she takes the gods. And she runs with them. Not the right thing to do. Not a wise thing to do. Because that is one of the things that sends Laban after them. But that's something that she does. And so Laban comes, chases after them. Chases after them for 7 days and overtakes them. And he says, I have the power to do you harm. In other words, he's got such a force with him that he could have rode over and wiped out all of Jacob's possessions, all of his household, all of his property, and plundered it and taken it back with him, with his two daughters. He could have done that. But he doesn't, because a surprising thing happens. God appears to Laban and says, don't say anything, good or bad, to Jacob. Now, when I was reading this, I don't know why, but a particular image just came flooding back, a memory of when I was at school. I remember walking down one of the school corridors. We had in our school a kind of a not necessarily a replica, but a version of the Cambridge Quad, right in the matric. It was called the matric quad. And I remember walking down one of the corridors of that quad, and as I was walking along, someone walked past me who I didn't get on particularly well with, and he made a threat to me and started threatening to how he was going to beat me up. Now, I wasn't overly anxious about this, but before I had time to think or reply, like a flash, a blur from my right hand side, came another one of my friends who hit him terribly hard, you know, like rugby tackled him against the wall, gripped him by the neck and said, if you touch him, then you'll have me to deal with too. And he was a much bigger lad than I was. He was a first team rugby player. And, you know, when that sort of an impact was made, you felt it and felt the force of it quite literally. And I don't know why, but when I was reading this passage, I kind of got the same impression. Here's Laban rushing in, making all sorts of threats, got the full force behind him, going to overtake Jacob and wipe him out and bring his daughters back with all of the possessions that Jacob had supposedly plundered or stolen from him. And then God appears to him, grabs him by the neck and says, you dare not say a thing to Jacob. He's mine. You'll have me to deal with. So God appears to him. God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream at night and said to him, be careful, watch out, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And this made such an impression on Laban that he comments on it himself. So he says in verse 29, I have the power to harm you, but last night the God of your father said to me, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. I had the power. I can do it, but I'm not going to because God spoke to me. So the warning was heeded. God intervenes in a very powerful way. And of course, after some discussion and after the searching of tents and a heated comment from Jacob back to Laban, they end up making a peace treaty. They pile a heap of stones together and they swear by that not to harm one another. A peace treaty is signed. Now, how does this help us? How does Jacob's journey through this and seeing how God is at work in and through this journey, how does that help us in our journey? Like we said right at the beginning, the Christian life is parallel to this. It often is. Throughout the Bible, we are likened to the Israelites who are journeying from one place to another. So all of us as individuals, as people who trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, have to take a journey. We have to take it. We have to go. No one can go for us. No one can go with us. One day we will die, or the Lord will return, and we will appear before Him on our own and give an account to Him on our own. And we are all on that journey. We do that together as a community of faith. One of the big purposes of being a church is that we can encourage one another in this journey. So there were just 3 points I wanted to make. 3 things I thought were overwhelming in terms of this journey. The first thing is, here's one reason why you should trust God and have confidence in Him as you journey to the promised land, to your own promised land. Not just the land of Canaan, but the new creation that God has promised. Here's one reason. Because God has given you His Word. God has given you His Word. Now, we have to remember that this is not simply a story about Jacob going home. This is a story about Jacob going to the land that God has promised him. So God reminds him of this in verse 13 when he's explaining what happened to his wives. He says that God appeared to him and he shows him the vision of the male goats mating with the flock are streaked and speckled and spotted. That's in verse 12. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land and at once and go back home to your native land. I am the God of Bethel, he says. Of all the names God could have taken for himself, or all the places he could have associated for himself, he chooses Bethel. And we know Bethel from just a few chapters before. So in chapter 28, God appears to Jacob in a dream at Bethel. And he makes a promise to him. So Jacob says, it says of Jacob that in verse 12 of chapter 28, he had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you to watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. See the significance there of referring to himself as that God, the God of Bethel, the God, the same God who made the promise to you that he will not leave you until he's brought you back to this land. This is not just about going home. We can't take this passage as an illustration of how God might have protected me and taken me home when I was walking home from my friend's house. It's not the same thing. What this is like for us is that we are heading to the promised land the same way Jacob is. But our promised land is greater, not just the land of Canaan. Our promise is better. It's the new creation, the new heavens, the new earth, the eternal promised land. that God has promised. And we're on that journey. We're going to that place. But the promise that he makes to his people still stands. The promise that he makes to his people still stands. He still says, I will not leave you. So if we think about the end of Matthew's gospel, for example, after Jesus has died and risen again, he appears to his disciples and he gives them that great commission, which we all know. But he says this in verse 18 of Matthew 28. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely, I am with you always, to the very end of age. Surely I am with you always to the end of age. Until this age is finished and that age begins, and I have brought you safely onto the new Canaan, the promised land, Canaan's shores. Until I've landed you there, until I've brought you there, I am with you always. I will not rest until I've done it. You go again to Hebrews chapter 11, and you see the same idea picked up. So in Hebrews 11, it goes on to talk about all the faithful saints who have kept their eyes on the promise. And then it says of Jesus, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, the one who began it and will finish it, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In other words, Jesus has gone. He's walked that road. He is the new and better Jacob. And Jacob is remarkable in this passage, because Jacob, for a change, is faithful. All the way through our chapter in Genesis, Jacob is affirming his faith, that he believes that God is with him. All the way through, he says, but the God of my father has been with me, in verse 5. In verse 7, however, God has not allowed Laban to harm me. Again in verse 9, so God has taken your father's livestock and has given them to me. Again in verse 11, when God speaks to him in the dream, affirming God's own presence with him. In verse 16, he says, surely Rachel and Leah affirm, surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to you. Belongs to you. And then when he's talking to Laban, he makes this statement of faith, this affirmation, which I think sums up the chapter. In verse 42 of chapter 31, he says, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, you would surely have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands. And last night, he rebuked you. God has been with me. God has seen me. God has protected me. Isn't that an encouragement for us? As we persevere, this is how God treats his people. He doesn't just give us the command. He doesn't just say, persevere. He doesn't just say, look, heaven's a great place. You need to hang on and get there. He says, I am with you. I have given you my word. I am with you always. I protect you. I see you. No one says it's going to be easy. It wasn't easy for Jesus. He, for the joy set before him, endured the cross in opposition to sinful men. And so will we. We will endure all kinds of things. Not only the life in a fallen world, which is common to all men, with diseases and relationship breakdowns. We will suffer those too. But more besides, because we follow the Lord and they crucified Jesus, they will oppose us too. And God doesn't just say, look, it's worth it. It is. But God goes beyond that. He says, I want you to go I want you to journey. Hold on to the promise that I have made you, because I am with you. I am with you always, even to the end of age. So let's draw encouragement from that, that God is with us, that God has given us His Word, and that we have the greater promise, the greater covenant leader, greater than Jacob, the new and better Jacob. We have Jesus. We have a new and better promised land. We have the new heavens and the new earth. And we have the Word made more fully known to us, that we know that Jesus is with us, that by His grace He heals us and He brings us safely onto Canaan's shore. So let's trust Him as we travel on our way to the promised land. We're going to pick that up in song now as we sing, "Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah," number 148 in the blue book. Number 148. Let's stand and sing.